Blog Talk Radio.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is our weekly round table of political pundits, political insiders, where we talk about everything political, inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, in your local communities and abroad. With us always, we've got a lot to talk about, so we're going to start the introductions and get brief about them real quick. But with us, as they are every Tuesday, joining us is, he is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the former parliamentarian of many Republican national conventions. He's also the former staff chief or floor chief for staff chief, floor chief for Gerald Ford. And he's also our general inside sage from the Republican Party. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be at Shelley's today.
It's a great day at Shelley's. Joining us as always, he is the Vice President of the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in New York in the District of Columbia. He is our international affairs expert. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks for being here. And Justin needs all the Fei Chong Hao.
Again,
you're doing an extremely good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And in his normal chair, back from places down south, is El Hombre, our amigo, our friend. He is a former 8th-term congressman from Washington's 2nd District. He is the Honorable Al Swift. Welcome back, Al. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, and I'm just to make set things straight. I'm the only Democrat around the table, so
he is a Democrat.
Be gentle.
He is a Democrat. He is a Democrat. We have a lot to talk about. The topic on everybody's mind this week and starting on Friday, and we continue to monitor the situation here at Shelley's Back Room here in the Nerve Center. We've got CNN up on the big screen, and we're continuing to watch the situation that occurred. For those of you who have been away or out of communication, obviously everybody knows that there was a magnitude 9.0 earthquake that happened off the northeast coast of Japan that also resulted in what can only be called a catastrophic tsunami, which came ashore in Japan. Thousands of lives have already been claimed. There are still many thousands missing. Entire towns and villages have been wiped out. It is truly, truly a catastrophic scene, and our hearts, everybody here at Backroom Politics, our hearts go out to the people in Japan. And we urge anybody who's listening out there, and we'll talk about this here in a second, that if you can give, if you have a dollar, if you have $10, $1,000, Japan needs our help. And now's the time we need to come together collectively to support our allies over in the Asia-Pacific Rim. But this is an event that is going to have huge implications. I can tell you right now, you know, everybody's seen the images coming from Japan. We can't comprehend anything like that happening here. I mean, we have visions of Katrina, but as catastrophic as Katrina was, we can't imagine something like that happening here. Al, you know, I know you just got back, so this is kind of news to you still. It's still a little fresh. What are your thoughts about what you've been seeing coming out of Japan?
Well, of all of the major disasters that have occurred during my lifetime, including the explosion of Mount St. Helens, and I was in the state at the time,
right?
Including the Twin Towers, including Katrina, I think this is by far the worst that I have ever heard. Hurting more people, devastating the economy of the country. It's going to take a long time for them to fight back, and they're going to have to do it through a lot of pain.
Bob, when you saw the images on TV, I mean, the images are just mind-blowing, along with just heart-wrenching. Those are the only words I can really come up with. As you're sitting there watching the news channels and the video, I mean, this is truly the first multimedia catastrophe that we've had where we've actually seen something like this come ashore. I mean, how does your mind comprehend that? I mean, you've been around government for so long. What are your thoughts?
Well, when I saw that tsunami wave coming inland and just moving, just like it was, it took up the whole picture frame of the television set. It was moving everything in front of it: buildings, houses, cars, whole neighborhoods were just disappearing as the wave just kept moving, and I could not believe it. It was almost like it was the first impression I had. It was almost like watching, one of these movies where the universe was being blown up by, you know, aliens and doing something that couldn't happen in the world without somebody and an outside force. I've never seen anything that looked so destructive right in front of my eyes as I watched it.
You bring up a good point. I mean, you know, this is stuff that we see in movies. We don't expect anything. This is something that comes out of Hollywood. We don't expect anything like this to happen for real. And, you know, this great, great lab of ours called Planet Earth just has a unique and amazing way of just righting itself or whatever. As a result, this type of catastrophic damage happens. Ralph, you are our international affairs pundit and our expert. You're very close to the Asia-Pac community. What are you hearing coming out of Japan? Have you had any reports coming out of there? Or?
Well, Justin, the Japanese Prime Minister has called this earthquake tsunami the worst crisis since World War II. And thankfully, American warships like the Ronald Reagan are bringing emergency supplies to the region. The U.S. is using its forces in Japan and rescue teams who have extensive knowledge about the nuclear power. As far as the personal tragedies, growing up in Hawaii, where we have had tsunamis, not on this magnitude, I always heard stories from friends and business contacts of my client about what it was like to survive a tsunami. But it doesn't bring it to life until you actually see the pictures on television. It's just absolutely horrific, and my heart goes out to the people of Japan.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned Hawaii. You obviously having family in Hawaii. Were they evacuated to higher ground? Was your family affected during the tsunami warning last Friday?
No, it wasn't. They were there fine. But the first thing I did was call home because I was very, very worried.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've got a good friend of mine, who is the sector commander out there for the U.S. Coast Guard. And her job is tremendous to begin with, but we finally got word on Saturday that she was fine, but she did move her family to higher ground in Oahu, in Honolulu.
Right.
Where Honolulu, Oahu was impacted by some of the waves, as was several harbors. One of them up by your way, Al. Yeah. There was a harbor in southwestern Oregon that was completely just wiped out. Millions and millions of dollars of damage. That type of force is just unfathomable.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of high waves and surf, but for the most part, Hawaii was left relatively unscathed.
And we are lucky for that. Yeah, we are
absolutely
truly fortunate for that. Al, you had mentioned that we've all seen disasters. We saw the footage coming out of Katrina. We saw, we've seen the images of 9/11. This is a time when, you know, after 9/11, our country came together. There was no politics. It was just, we are one America, and we have one voice, and we will rectify that problem. That was a man-made act of terrorism. A natural disaster like this, we saw it during Katrina, where Americans came together, and collectively our hearts went out to the residents of New Orleans and southern Louisiana. The Japanese people, you've had interactions with the Japanese government before, Al. They are a very conservative people, a very compassionate people. How do you think that the Japanese people could recover from something like this, in your view?
Well, if you can recover from the Second World War through tenacity, hard work, stiff upper lip, which you usually ascribe to the British, but I think it's also true of the Japanese, if they can do that, they can do this. I think that it's fortunate in one sense that they are a very highly developed country. If they were compared with Haiti, where they really had nothing to work with, Japan's in a better position. They're in a worse situation, but they're in a better position to work with it. I think they're just going to have to rely on their own guts and their intelligence to work their way through it, and I think they will. It won't be easy.
Bob, in your experience here in Washington, in dealing with the foreign governments, particularly that of Japan, Japan's been a tremendous ally. In your view, has the American government truly stepped up and met the call to support the Japanese government and help in aid, help in recovery efforts, etc.?
Well, I think you'll see in the coming days and weeks a great deal more. In the first couple of days, at least what I could tell, was everybody was so stunned by what they were seeing. It was almost unbelievable. But I know we've already, Ralph said, the USS
Ronald
Reagan is already out there, and other supplies are on their way, and I'm sure we will be doing everything we can to help our friends in Japan. But it is just horrifying to see that wave of water just destroying things.
To have it occur now is another whole dimension of the problem.
Right, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that in the coming segments. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we definitely. I mean, the global
economy.
Yeah. Oh, the global economy, the way it is, to have this on top of it. And we're going to talk about the economic and political and civil ramifications. Ralph, you had a thought.
I think what's so horrific is not just the tragic loss of life, but what's been reported with several of Japan's nuclear power plants, where radiation has been escaping from the plants into the atmosphere. Very similar to what happened in Chernobyl.
Yeah, and that brings up a whole another topic. There's a lot of topics that surround what's happening in Japan. The Japanese people are by no means out of the woods right now. You've got the situation at Fukushima nuclear power plant, where three of the reactors are now in a condition that could cause meltdown. One of them, Fukushima 3, they're anticipating a meltdown. The Japanese government, as of a few hours ago, has now expanded the evacuation zone to 30 kilometers, basically 20 miles from what was originally set as 12. So the hot zone continues to expand, which does not bode well for the Japanese people in that part of the country.
No.
When we look at this, and by the way, for those of you out there are listening, if you have any thoughts, comments, would like to ask any questions of the roundtable, we invite you to call in. Our call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. If you have any comments, thoughts about what you saw, about the implications this tragedy is going to have globally, please, we invite you to call in and give us your thoughts.
Are we going to talk about the impact on the U.S. nuclear?
We are. We absolutely are, Al, and we'll probably talk about that in our next segment. But right now, just focusing on the larger global scale, Ralph, you've been actively involved in the political scene, and you have a lot of connections, obviously, in Japan. When we see, we saw, as Bob pointed out, how, and Al in particular pointed out, how they recovered after World War II. They became the third largest economy in the world, second to the United States and China.
Right.
There was a time when quality products were made by the Japanese people because of their commitment to excellence. Can they, as a people, truly rally around themselves and build back up what ultimately has been I don't want to say destroyed, but truly, truly impacted?
I think they can recover, but there's several factors that have to be taken into consideration. Japan has the largest public debt among advanced economies, and this disaster obviously is going to hurt Japan economically. It's already been projected $30 billion in damages from the quake, and that's projected to increase based on the nuclear damage and the growing threat of a nuclear meltdown. As we know, Japan is number two behind China in the amount of U.S. Treasury bonds that they hold, over $800 billion. Now, it's obvious that Japan is going to have to cash out some of these treasury bonds in order to pay for the damage that's been generated by this quake and tsunami, and that could have a devastating impact on our country.
No, there's no question about that. No question about that. We're at the quarter past the hour. We're going to take our first break here. We'll be back in 2 minutes. When we come back, I want to talk about the nuclear situation. We'll go into some detail about what happened, some of the emergency response capabilities that the Japanese have put into place, and the implications on the nuclear power sector globally, how that's going to be affected. Again, we invite you to call in 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Again, we invite you to call in 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. We're talking about the crisis in Japan right now. And before the break, we started touching on the situation with the nuclear power plants in northeastern Japan, it is truly a dangerous, dangerous situation. It is truly a situation that nobody in the world has ever experienced before, where we've got several power plants with generation that has been exposed, overheated. We have one power plant, Fukushima Power Plant, which has three units. Number three is currently in a state of what would be considered the beginnings of a meltdown. But yeah, it does beg the question. Number one, Japan has truly been on, and Ralph, you can kind of jump on this. Japan truly has been on the forefront of the utilization of nuclear power as a source of energy. Does this make them reconsider nuclear as a form of power for them?
Well, I think they will want to look at the extra upgrades that the U.S. put in place in their systems post 9/11 to ensure that the water would get directly to the core and cool it right away in order to avoid a scenario like you're seeing in Japan. So what's happening is you have to put the vapor through some sort of filtering process, but there's not enough clear water, so they're putting in the seawater, and a substantial part of the reactor is melting down.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean Japan, the Japanese arguably are very prepared culture.
So, right.
They are, you know, anything that we would do here in the United States as far as preparedness, they do four times over. When we look at the nuclear power plants, the Japanese nuclear power plants actually have a tremendous amount of built-in redundancies to ensure that something like this would not happen. But nobody could have forecasted when they were building these power plants, they had earthquakes in mind. They had tsunamis in mind. But a 9.0 earthquake, which is the largest that's been recorded in modern history, and it's the largest earthquake in the history of the country of Japan, as well as a large-scale tsunami destroying a lot of the power infrastructure there, nobody foresaw that. Now, we have a situation where the emergency cooling control system was in place, ready for the earthquake, but when the earthquake shook and the tsunami took out a lot of that infrastructure, it took a lot of those power generation units offline, thus rendering the ECCS, the cooling system, useless. Can we truly, I mean, when we talk about nuclear power, and this is going to stir up, I mean, Germany just reported that there's a large-scale call for shutting down the nuclear power plants in Germany. Germany's not going to have a tsunami anytime soon.
Yeah.
Why the overreaction? Al, you've been around energy policy for a long time. Nuclear energy is relatively safe if done correctly, and the Japanese have really done it correctly in many instances.
One of the things that we hesitate to examine is that any way you produce power has got some dangers. We have just seen the whole situation in the Gulf with an oil spill, which really sent a lot of people thinking maybe even nuclear power isn't so bad. Now this has happened. Now all we need is for Grand Coulee to fall down, and we'll take that. There is no way to produce power that does not carry with it some dangers. And that's a reality that we have to deal with. When I served on the Energy Subcommittee years ago, and I don't have up-to-date information, but I remember going through all of the sources of energy, coal and oil and nuclear, and new ones, you know, wind, which at that time was just fledgling and nowhere near the capacity that we now have. And I could not figure out a way we were going to provide the energy needs projected for the United States without having nuclear power. And therefore, we are between a rock and a hard place. If we don't want oil because of spills, we don't want dams because of fish, we don't want even windmills because of birds, and we don't want nuclear power because of this, what are we going to do? This is a real societal problem for the world, and particularly for the United States.
Well, Bob, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell came out the other day, actually on Sunday during one of the Talking Head shows, and came out and said that, you know, we as a country cannot, we have a tendency of governing through reaction. When the oil spill happened, we tried to re-regulate and tried to govern and create legislation that would regulate that industry. And now as a result of what's happening in Japan, there's now a call for us to re-regulate the nuclear power plants here in the United States. Are we truly that reactionary, and does that really hamper our ability to develop safe sources of energy?
I don't think so. I think what you're seeing in the way of reaction to the Japanese tragedy here, you're seeing the people who don't want nuclear using this as an opportunity to remind everybody that nuclear is not super safe. It does have problems like everything else. As Al said, there's no way to get power without doing something that can be dangerous in one way or another or damaging. And I think that the fact that nuclear power is clean, and as Al says, if we're gonna be able to slow down our use of fossil fuels, it's the only alternative. I mean, there is absolutely no way on God's earth that wind power is ever going to do you a damn bit of good in the southeast in the summertime when there's not a breath of fresh air moving. We can't do it. We have to use what we've got available to us that's clean, and nuclear is clean, and it is fundamentally safe. You said it very well a moment ago. When the earthquake hit, the power plants were wonderful. They were successfully operational. They were safe. Everything was good. What killed them was the fact that the power got knocked out by the tsunami, and they couldn't cool the reactors down. Now, you almost can't imagine something as double-dipping as that, so to speak, a double whammy, if you will, hitting the power surge. So the fact of the matter is, I believe fundamentally, as Al does, that there's nuclear has got to be part of our future. Clean, safe nuclear energy policy. And the fact of the matter is, we do know how to build plants that are very safe. We knew how to build plants that have triple and redundancies to make sure they are safe. But nothing is absolutely, positively never going to cause a problem.
Al, we have one good thing about this with regard to overreaction. Yes, there will be overreaction. Congressman got to go home and talk to the Kiwanis Club, and they're saying, what are you going to do about this? So you always hear voices in Congress and among the columnists and what have you that suggest all kinds of immediate things. The fact is, we can't move that fast. We can't do anything permanent in the immediate future. And in the meantime, we'll know a lot more about what happened in Japan. We'll know a lot more about what didn't happen there. And we'll be able to then begin to put together, I think we'll have some new policies, but I think they will be more thoughtful than if we were to try and write something today.
Ralph. And I think the Japanese people are very supportive of nuclear, because they recognize that it has been a benefit for their society. This was truly an act of God to have an earthquake followed by a tsunami, and they took all reasonable expected precautions. So I don't think there was much more that they could have done to keep people safe.
It now begs the question of when we look at the Japanese people, and again, a very prepared, a very conservative culture, they'll want to, at least my impression is, they'll want to rebuild these nuclear sources of energy and implement them as part of their infrastructure. I don't think that'll detract them. But we do have a possibility, you know, of having a Chernobyl-like dead zone in northeast Japan. I mean, a 30-mile area of contaminated, inhabitable part of that country. Will that offshoot it, or will that derail there?
I think... the fact of the matter is the Japanese have been very open about the situation. They've asked for foreign help and expertise to come in right away. What the Russians tried to do is they tried to, in effect, cover it up. It was only after the Swedes made a point of bringing it to the world's attention because a dark cloud came over into the atmosphere. Did the Russians start to come forward about what was happening in Chernobyl?
Right,
we've hit it right away with Japan. So the more technology, the more people, the more aid that we can get over to them, we'll be able to kind of avert the situation becoming a major Chernobyl situation.
One has to admit that the Japanese government has been very open about the information that they've been letting out, not only internally, but also to the international community. They've been very upfront, and it's surprising, too, because, again, the Japanese government has not been exactly the most stable. They're on their third prime minister in 2 years. In your opinion, Bob, has the Japanese government met the mark as far as letting everybody know in their response?
Well, not only have they let everybody know, but they have asked for expertise and help. And a number of our top people in this area of nuclear safety are already over there, are on their way. And, you know, they're looking for the best help they can get, and they're being very open about it. They're doing everything right. You know, as Ralph said, it's a double whammy, an act of God. It hit them. And it's a terrible problem, but they are open, and they're trying to get expert help over there and do the best they can, and that's all you can hope for.
Does anybody know what France is doing? I mean, they are one of the most nuclear-based countries. Are they?
I think 60% of their power is nuclear.
Is nuclear, correct.
Yeah. There's at least 7 countries that are already offered to help. I think France may be one of them, but we can check on that.
My understanding is that they're not having the surge or the uproar against nuclear power that they might be seeing in Germany, for example. The German people are just adamant about reinvestigating nuclear as a source of energy for their infrastructure.
Germany has always been nervous about nuclear.
Right. Back to you, Al. In looking at how the Japanese government has reacted, I mean, is there anything that you can see just in what you've seen through the media that they could have done differently, or is this textbook exactly what the expectation of a central government should be?
You're talking to somebody who doesn't know a damn thing about nuclear power. So I probably, the most accurate answer is I don't know, but it certainly seems like they have taken all the appropriate steps. Certainly the observers that are there that know more about it than I do haven't questioned any of the actions that they've taken. So I think they're doing a pretty good job.
I think the key is the Japanese authorities are preparing for a meltdown. So they have the correct mindset, they have the expertise, the people coming over there to help. Everyone is getting there, and they will have people on the ground to avert this as a major disaster.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, you know, as somebody who came from the emergency response community before, I will tell you that from an emergency response standpoint, my thought is that at least what I can see through media reports and through reports I've gotten through friends of mine, that they've really hit the mark as far as responding to this type of catastrophe. They're not taking any chances. I mean, to literally evacuate an area that far in wasn't as damaged as it was on the Northeast Coast, to truly evacuate that area that far out is truly remarkable. I mean, that's a gutsy move from a central government displacing that. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, but just to be on the safe side. Now, we did see a report earlier that the radiation levels were dropping in a couple of the units that were in question, so that's good news. Perhaps the seawater effect is starting to take its toll. But I can tell you, in response to, I mean, not only to have a tsunami and an earthquake, and now to have a major nuclear disaster as a possibility, is truly taxing the full response capabilities of the public safety infrastructure in Japan. I got to tell you, I would venture to say America might be as good as the Japanese have put out there, and if we had a similar situation, God forbid we have a situation like what they've got there in the Japanese islands.
I think another point that, that indicates how strongly they are reacting, and that is that dumping seawater into a nuclear reactor probably destroys the nuclear reactor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It absolutely does. It absolutely does.
They knew that going in, and they didn't hesitate to do it.
Right. When we look at nuclear power, and we, I mean, those, anybody associated with nuclear power right now is taking a hit on this because of what's happening in Japan. Bob, your former employer, GE, is taking a very large hit. Their stock went down tremendously.
Yeah.
In fact, not to call them out, but GE was the designer 40 years ago of Fukushima. We're seeing power companies, private power companies, FPL, Entergy, those companies, those investor-owned utilities that are taking hits because they own nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
And for some reason, those who are investing in the stock market think, oh my gosh, it's going to be a danger here.
Yeah.
Is that logical?
No.
Or?
It's not logical, but it's very human. That's what it comes down to. It's very human. People are scared. They think about it. I mean, if it could happen there, it could happen here. Is probably the way people look at it. Some of them, anyway. And investors, in the marketplace, thinking there'll be people who own stocks in companies with nuclear interest will start selling. So the smart guys are selling real quick today to cut their losses.
The real smart ones are probably buying.
And the real smart ones will be buying by tomorrow or the next
right.
day. The guys who are selling yesterday are going to be buying next week.
Yeah, I mean,
it's also time to buy, no question.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything, I mean, and Al, you being a member of the Energy Subcommittee, you were privy to a lot of the arguments for and against nuclear power. When you see this type of reaction, can the American nuclear power community recover from this type of outcry?
Well, they were on the rise. I mean, they were even having some environmentalists saying, well, maybe we better take another look at this. That will go away, I'm sure. I think I've always thought this country didn't do it right.
How so?
If we turned nuclear power over to anybody but the utilities, I think people would have been much more comfortable. Utilities in this country do not have a history, going clear back to the very beginning, that gives you a lot of confidence that they have the public interest deeply at heart. They wouldn't provide power into rural areas, and there are all kinds of things they did from the beginning of their history. So I think that a single plan developed and approved by the government so that we can build them faster and not have to have each one slightly different so that it has to be reviewed and reviewed and reviewed would help. And with you three Republicans, you can now go through the ceiling. I think maybe the plants themselves should be run by the government, sell the power to the private utilities and let them wheel it, and put people who don't have a profit motive in charge of operating the plants.
And that is happening in both France and China, where the Chinese privatized a lot of these state-owned companies, including the nuclear energy facilities, as a way to continue to grow and expand nuclear energy capabilities within the country. So
and the idea that I suggested may be one of the changes that could be offered to sweeten the pot to help us move ahead with nuclear energy.
Let me try and simplify it. I mean, are you talking about a central government-run nuclear energy resource?
Not a resource, a
central nuclear utility almost?
Yes.
So
really?
Bypasses all of the red tape.
It would be inherent that the government would be doing the red tape that would have to be reduced. But my thought is if you didn't build each one to a different plan, you could streamline that process a very great deal, reduce the costs, and still assure maximum safety.
Bob, what do you think on that?
Well, I'm not so sure I that it's, I'm not so sure it's a bad idea. As a Republican, I would normally be, you know, one who believes a free enterprise can do things better than government, and history is there to prove it. But this may be a case of where an idea like Al's is not a bad one. I will say one thing. I think the first time we're going to know where our government thinks we ought to go is whether the administration decides to do something other than support and help fund the two plants that have already been approved that are down in Georgia, that have already been approved, and we have said we're going to step up and do this. And obviously, I will be interested to know whether the government continues to decide they're going to, you know, in effect, help fund those plants.
Does something like this give the Nuclear Regulatory Commission a lot more strength? Is it something that we're going to see a lot more prevalence in the coming months and years?
Well, it strikes me that something like this happening in Japan is going to reverberate here very, very significantly, which means to me that the government is going to take another look at things, for no other reason than to make sure that they can, if they want to go forward with nuclear power, they're going to have to find some way to help ensure in the public mind that they're doing everything they can to be safe.
Now,
I believe that it will be impossible to do nothing. The government is going to have some action it's going to take to respond to this. I think there are a number of intelligent things we can do in that regard, and there are a number of stupid things we can do, and it will depend on ultimately, whether we have nuclear power or not will depend on whether they do something intelligent.
But it seems like we're in a catch-22. You brought it up. We don't want nuclear because we're seeing what's happening at Fukushima and a couple of the other plants in Japan. We don't want windmills because of birds. We don't want hydropower because of fish. There's a catch-22 situation here. Obviously, we're not going to make everybody happy. But where's the logical balance that sits that makes this thing viable again?
I don't know. This is the great giant of all not in my backyard things.
Right.
And not with that technology kind of a thing. And we've got to be able to make the point to the American public that we need to ask people, what would you do? I mean, lay out the facts of how much energy we're going to need and how much we can get from various sources and do the equations.
Bob, you had a comment?
Well, I think that's exactly what we have to do. I think that the fact of the matter is we all agree, I think most Americans agree, that the more we are dependent upon foreign sources for energy, i.e. petroleum, the more problems we have, because they're unstable, more so than ever now, as we look at the Middle East. And obviously, the nuclear is something we can do without any worries about Middle Eastern instability. But the fact of the matter is, and I think it's fair to say, Al said it earlier, even some of the environmentalists early have now believed, after many years of the plants we have in America working fine, that maybe nuclear is not the worst of all possible worlds. Maybe imported oil is.
Yeah.
The fact that some environmentalists are beginning to think that way, I think is a good sign. But I also think that everybody ought to pull back a little bit and make sure that they feel comfortable. And we have to make sure we do designs. And I think Al has the right idea in one sense. There ought to be some kind of a standard design.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a comment, though.
I've had an idea for years, and I don't know quite how to implement it, but this might be a simple enough, I'll explain that in a minute, idea that we can do this. I think one of the ways to educate the American public to a variety of problems, I think it could work with a budget, it could work with other, is some great entrepreneur out there, I give them the idea for free, put together a computer game that lists all the sources of energy and the quantities that are available, and balance that against what our energy needs are likely to be for the next 20, 30, 40 years, and let them play with it themselves and quickly learn that you can't eliminate nuclear power and drilling in the ocean and take dams down and all of that and expect to meet our needs.
But it's a NIMBY, it's a not in my backyard, a NIMBY situation where I don't want to pay $4 a megawatt for my electricity, but I also don't want the source of that electricity being a nuclear power plant 20 miles away where I could see an evacuation zone resulting.
Look at California. I mean, they haven't built any power plants there in over 25 years. And they're having an enormous problem.
And that's where I'm saying if you could make available for 1995 a program for that anybody could put on their computer and just start moving stuff around and see how they're going to do it.
But again, we get to a situation where it's how can we do that? We if you were to put that program together today, it's like preparing for whatever. Nobody in their right mind would have prepared for all of the levees in New Orleans breaking and flooding the lower bowl that is known as Orleans Parish. Nobody would have predicted a 9.0 earthquake and a catastrophic tsunami coming in. Just as, you know, in order to have a program like that, you literally have to try and think of everything. If we try and use the foreign sources of oil, we have the instability in the Middle East coming into play, and that fluctuates the demand.
I think you could program into this program that I'm talking about risks based on history. For example, natural gas pipelines. In my hometown of Bellingham, Washington, they had a terrible natural gas pipeline mm-hmm. explosion, killed two people, and just wiped out a whole park and so forth. So everything brings with it some, and we've got enough history on enough of these things that you could include in the program a little bit of what the risks are.
Yeah.
And you have to look at the security of this country. We're in a very vulnerable position if we have to rely on foreign countries to supply our energy resource needs. We've got to focus on harnessing our energy needs in this country, and that means we have to seriously look at nuclear.
Okay. Well, we're coming up. We've gone long on this segment talking about nuclear power and what's happening in Japan. We're going to stay on the topic of Japan. When we come back, the economic ramifications are going to be huge on this. So stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Down.
Politics live from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street, the Nation's Cigar Tavern on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me as always, our usual roundtable, the Honorable Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, who's off doing Bob Hines type stuff, Dr. Ralph Winnie, our international affairs expert. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And we're continuing to talk about the Japanese catastrophe involving the tsunami, involving the earthquake, a destruction on a magnitude that we in our lifetime have not seen. It's a natural disaster, an act of God, however you want to call it, but the devastation and the pictures coming out of Japan are truly, truly heart-wrenching. We collectively urge anybody listening out there to be generous. Donate $1, donate $10, donate $100 to the charity of your choice that's helping out and providing aid to our friends in Japan, and our hearts go out to the citizens of a true ally in the Pacific Rim. But one of the things we were talking about before, we started to breach on before the break, is the economic situation. The economic situation is something that we're going to feel for months, if not years, to come. We just heard word that the Bank of Japan has just infused $180 billion into the Japanese financial infrastructure. But we've also heard that Toyota, Sony, Honda, many of the major industrial components inside the Japanese economy will stop production for a time yet to be determined. We're also seeing a lot of the core infrastructure, power, water, rail, highways, being impacted on that. So the transportation and utility infrastructure is something that's going to be impacted for months, if not years, to come. So the economic ramifications, let's be honest, Japan is the third largest economy in the world. They have their hands in so many other economies. They are the second largest holder of collective debt of the United States. And they've already announced that they're going to have to cash in on some of that just to keep the Japanese economy viable in the future. So let's talk about the economic impacts. Ralph, you're familiar with the Asia-Pacific, the economies of scale, and how their economies affect us. Let's look first at the impact of the Japanese economy internally. What are we looking at here? How catastrophic is this to the economy of the third largest in the world?
Well, as I said before, they have the largest public debt among advanced economies. And you have over $30 billion in damages just from this earthquake and tsunami, which is expected to rise.
That number is going to continue to grow, arguably.
Right. They already have one of the highest corporate tax rates of all OECD countries. And
for those who are not familiar, OECD countries are?
Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development.
Okay.
And they may have to come make the painful decision to raise taxes in Japan. And are the people going to be supportive of something like that? Are they going to want their sales tax, property taxes? Are land and construction costs are going to go up? Like you said, the Japan is shutting down for over a month. There's no tourism. There's no business development. It's going to set the country back economically for at least several years.
How can an economy like Japan, and I'll pose this to Al, how does an economy like Japan try and offset that impact, or can they?
you need to ask an economist, which I am not. On the other hand, it was Harry Truman who said that a bunch of economists would all point in every direction. So I'm not sure there's an answer there. I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I don't know that there is anybody in the world right now that could answer that question with any specificity. I think things need to settle down a little bit, whether we're talking days or weeks, to be able to assess things. We haven't even talked about their problem of providing food for their people, providing housing for their people. All of that is going to be very, very costly.
And there's still areas in northern Japan that have been cut off by the tsunami and the floodwaters.
Oh, the tsunami wipe. I mean, you look at the Miyagi Prefecture. You're talking about an entire area the size of Rhode Island almost being completely leveled.
Right.
And they're still not sure of the total amount of destruction in that prefecture. Most of the northeastern prefectures are going to see impacts that they may never recover from.
Yeah. I'd like to ask Ralph a question because I haven't got the foggiest idea about how serious this is, but he has mentioned the fact that the Japanese are going to likely have to sell some of the bonds that that we have issued, and we'll have to pay them off if they come here. How's that going to impact our economy?
Well, that gets back to the question that we've raised the last couple of weeks about raising the debt ceiling.
Yep.
Because we're going to hurt us economically if they cash in these treasury bonds.
There's an interesting thing going on right now, and there is a debate as to whether we should move militarily or not in on Gaddafi. Okay. Now we're still in Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan. Now some people want us to become more and more involved in everything that's going on in North Africa. And where's the money coming from? I mean,
the big X factor, I think, with Japan is going to be what China does. China has given billions of dollars in foreign aid to other countries to help develop their economies. Are they willing to invest the same amount of money in Japan, which has traditionally been an enemy of theirs for many, many years?
Well, this obviously begs the question. You know, if the Japanese government, who has already come out and said, we're going to have to cash in some of these treasury bonds that we're holding, we're calling in the note.
Yeah.
You know, and on top of that, we're going to have, you know, there's a call for us to respond with no-fly zones and peppering runways with artillery, creating basically almost a third front enforcement zone. Do we even have the cash if Japan has to cash in those treasury bonds to even pay for something like that? I mean, we're talking about a huge chunk of money that they're calling the note on.
We have to rely on other countries to buy more treasury bonds to offset the amount that Japan is going to have to cash out.
But now we're in a catch-22.
If we just start printing money,
right,
we're going to run up an inflationary situation pretty damn quickly.
Right, and then all of a sudden we got people in wheelbarrows trying to buy bread.
Yeah.
You know, and then we've got another situation. You know, who's going to buy this? We can't go to the EU because they've got Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. We can't go to the Asian PAC countries because the people we would normally go to, our number two buyer is pretty much in a state of chaos. And China just can't buy anymore because they're tapped out.
Right.
So who buys this? Who?
What about the Russians? They're another country that has bought a lot of treasury bonds. It raises the national security interests.
This is a very tangled web that we're weaving in just having a natural disaster like what has happened in Japan. The ripple effect of this is, I mean, I didn't even think about the idea of, you know, does Russia buy some of these treasury bonds to offset this, or do we just step back and let the rest of the world go, hey, look, we're on our own. We got our own problem.
And the problem is the dollar is pegged to a lot of different currencies. So if the dollar starts to go down, you could see a major worldwide recession.
Does this cause, Lee asked this question, does this cause the Chinese to reevaluate the devaluation of their currency in relation to the dollar?
Possibly. They're going to certainly take that into account. They're going to look at what is in their economic and political interests to help Japan. I mean, they could maybe If they build up Japan's economy, what is that going to do for China? Are they going to build up another enemy to attack them?
Well,
their mindset is.
Well, we're looking at a situation where right now, you know, China. I mean, you're very familiar, obviously, Ralph, with the Chinese mindset and the Chinese government. And I hate to ask this question after such a tragedy, but does the Chinese government look at this as an opportunity? I mean, are they that opportunistic that they would capitalize on something like this, saying, hey, you can't get your really nice cars, you can't get your Lexuses, your Toyotas, your Hondas. Hey, you know what? You might want to buy some of our cars. You might have to invest in some of our infrastructure in order to offset that.
The interesting thing is the Japanese economy is very difficult to get into. Once you're in there, you tend to make a lot of money. And the Chinese recognize that, Chinese and the U.S. and other countries. And this would be a great opportunity for China to be able to get their products into Japan to make a lot of money.
Does that, Al, that you're cringing on that?
I'm cringing not at what Ralph said.
Right.
I was thinking of something. I'm going back to a point I made. if we learn anything from this, we should learn that the crisis we face today is not going to be the last crisis we're going to face.
Right.
We really should be doing something very different than we are doing in North Africa, in my judgment. But we really don't have the capability to do that. We're not in a position to do all that we would probably like to do with this crisis in Japan. And here we're stuck with these two old wars. I mean, we've been in Afghanistan longer than we've been in anywhere else. And it ties us down so that we cannot do other things that come along. My view is that we should never have gone into Iraq, and so Hussein would still be there.
Al, I'm going to disagree with you. I think that we cannot dictate. I mean, basically, we're armchair quarterbacking at that point.
Of course, but the lesson we can learn is if we ever get out of this mess, we should remember as we commit ourselves in various places militarily and otherwise, that there will always be another crisis coming, and we need to have the slack.
All right.
What this also shows us is how interdependent so many countries are, one way or another, with everybody else. You almost anything you do, or anything that happens, reverberates, and it reverberates all over the place. I mean, the idea that an earthquake in Japan is causing problems for us over here, you don't put them together.
Well, it just shows how intertwined the global economy is.
That's exactly the point.
But I want to go back to Al's point and the thought of, you know, understandably, you know, those who not learn from history are destined to repeat it. I understand that, but when
did you just create that aphorism?
No, it's very famous aphorism, actually, Al. But the question I pose to you is: look, when we talk about, you were saying that we should be engaged in Libya. Is that correct or not?
I think we should.
What is it? Okay,
but I don't think we can.
Let me give you a situation. We have an iron-fisted dictator who has attacked his own people inside his own borders, causing a definite threat to our national security. I just described Libya, or did I just describe Iraq? I mean, Gaddafi's been pretty much out of the public scene until Egypt started popping up and until there was an uprising in Tripoli.
But there is an uprising in Libya. There wasn't an uprising in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction. We didn't need to do that. It's a done deal.
I guess my question to you is, and we're kind of getting off on a tangent here. Al, have a drink of water. You need it, sir. My question to you is, and I'll draw it out, is what is the difference between, you know, other than the question of weapons of mass destruction, what's the difference between what happened in Iraq versus what's happening in Libya, and why would our response be different? Both arguably create a threat to our national security. Both arguably require a military response of some sort, whether it's invasion or enforcing a no-fly zone, both are technically considered active wars.
Well,
Bob, go ahead.
I think that it's fair to say that had we moved earlier in Libya, we would have a bigger problem than we know what to do with in one sense. And it was only yesterday that the Arab League said, in effect, we think there ought to be a no-fly zone. And that's the first time the Arab League had said that one of their own members is in such a bad shape and is causing so much trouble that we agree that the world ought to go in there and do something. And you can't move without, we couldn't move without the Arab League saying that. We, not only meaning America, but the Western world, NATO, the European Union, you name it. So we had to have that approval, and by the time we got it, which was yesterday, I think it's too late.
But it's arguably too late.
Yes.
I mean,
pretty much over the last fortress.
Right.
If the Arab League would have moved a week ago, it would have been a different story, maybe. But not now.
But I guess my question, and I don't necessarily disagree with Al, as far as, you know, do we get involved in the situation in North Africa? Obviously, it's an unstable part of the world. It's obviously got implications on our national security. But, and it is absolutely amazing to me that we can tie in how do we support one of our greatest allies in the Asia-Pacific Rim, or do we send money to them, or do we pepper runways in Tripoli with a military force enforcing a no-fly zone called out for by the Arab League?
Well, we're having to rely on our allies. We may have to rely
our
on
allies
Canada.
Can't afford it.
Well, Canada, Australia, Singapore may be asked to provide more and more money to help the quake victims in Japan. That would free us up to be able to help the people in the Middle East.
But we can't afford it if Japan is having to cash in bonds.
That's the other
in order for them to just rebuild an economy that we are so interdependent on. So, I mean,
it's a vicious circle that we're in.
It is. And Al, I got to ask, not to jump on the R versus D bandwagon here, but from a D perspective, how do we truly offset this vicious circle? Is there a break in the circle that we can create?
What I'm saying is that I don't see how we can do that now. But if we weren't, if Iraq had never happened, we would probably be in a position where we could handle both of these crises I'm talking about, contributing to the destabilization of the dictatorial governments in North Africa, where the people are already rising up and where there are all kinds of things we might be able to do to help if we had the money and the time and the attention to spend on it. And we're still trying to clean up after Iraq, for crying out loud.
But, I mean, we can connect the dots all day long and say this goes back to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, that we empowered the Taliban when we were going in there during Charlie Wilson's war. Had we not done that and let Russia be Russia, we wouldn't have had this problem with Osama bin Laden, and we wouldn't have had an issue of Islamic radicals flying airplanes into the World Trade Center, and we wouldn't have had to have gone into Afghanistan. We wouldn't have had to gone into Iraq. How far back do we have to go to connect these dots?
Vietnam, probably.
I mean, and even then, you know, if we had allowed Douglas MacArthur to and George Patton to invade Russia, you know, do we stop there? I mean, there's a whole litany of dots that we can connect in this.
I understand. The distinction that I am making is that in Northern Africa, you have rebellions going on. You didn't have any rebellion in Iraq. And it's pretty clear now we didn't need to do that. And a lot of people didn't think we needed to do it at the time. I voted against it.
But even the Kurdish separatists, you wouldn't say that the Kurdish separatists were in fact insurgents or they were uprising, thus causing Saddam Hussein to use chemical weapons against his own people in the north?
I don't know.
Bob?
Well, he was certainly doing it.
He did it.
Yeah.
We encouraged people to engage in an uprising to overthrow Hussein.
We've done that for years. We've encouraged people to uprise against, strong-armed dictators.
Look at Bay of Pigs. We were supposed to have provided the air support. to the Cubans.
I'll tell you, it is truly, truly remarkable. And by the way, I mean, this is a great, great point of the idea that, you know, we truly live in a global community. It's also a great point that we can also disagree and be civil with each other and listen to everybody's point without demagoguery.
That's what we're all about.
Exactly, exactly. So for kids out there that are listening, this is how politics should be done. We can disagree all day long and still have a mutual respect for each other. God knows I've got a huge, tremendous amount of respect for Congressman Al. But when we come back, I want to get back on the topic with the Japan situation for a last segment before we go into the bottom of the hour. I want to talk about the continued political situation and the political ramifications of what's going on in Japan. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Thank you.
we're back live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on a glorious but cool late March springtime day. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio, and for those of you who are joining us for the past segments, we've been talking about the catastrophe in Japan and the implications that's going to have on the global economy, on the internal economy in Japan. It's just been a great discussion, and again, our hearts go out to the citizens of Japan. It is truly, truly a heart-wrenching situation that's going on over there. And again, we urge anybody that can to donate to the appropriate charities to help them get back on their feet, because God knows we need Japan as an ally going down the road. Now, with us as always is Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, myself, Justin Russell, your moderator here on Backroom Politics. We invite you to call in our last segments. Please, if you have any comments about what's happening in Japan or globally or the implications or any personal thoughts, please call us, 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We were talking in the last segment about the global economic, and we kind of got into an amazing subject about how truly live in a global community where we can tie in the crisis in Libya and the crisis in the Middle East to the implications of that the tsunami and the earthquake had. Those are really broad dots to connect, but again, we live in a type of world today that we can do that. For every equal action, there's an equal reaction. So what I want to talk about now is the political outfall from what's happening here, both domestically and internationally. Let's start first internationally and work our way back to the States. Ralph is our international political pundit. Japan has always been a strong voice and a strong political power in the Asian Pacific Rim. We've seen them react accordingly to global and world events, but we've also seen that the Japanese government has been a very unstable government internally. They've had crises involving scandals with their prime minister, scandals in their governing legislature. Can they in fact politically recover? What's going to happen politically internally as a result of this?
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see if the Japanese people are willing to pay higher taxes.
Now,
I mean, they're going to have to raise taxes. They're going to have to raise their corporate tax. They're going to have to raise the sales tax to pay for the damage suffered by the earthquake. In addition, as we said before, to cashing in the treasury bonds. This is going to mean the Japanese people are going to have to work longer hours. They're going to have to create some sort of tax breaks and other incentives to bring companies back into the country in order to stimulate economic growth and development.
You know, when you talk about the Japanese worker, I always go back to a movie, great movie with Michael Keaton called Gung Ho. And it was almost a caricature of the Japanese work culture. They have this, whether you want to call it a stereotype or this mindset of everything is done for the company, done for the betterment and the quality of the output. Is that perception true?
It's starting to change among the younger generation. You're getting a lot of hippies that are coming up among the younger generation in Japan. The older generation that set up the major companies like Daihatsu and
you mean Sony, Toyota,
right? They came out. They were, many of them came out of the military culture, and they kind of after Japan was defeated, and they were the ones that basically set up the companies from at the ground level and worked long hours to make these companies very, very successful. Younger generations become more Western, and they're not used to working as hard as the older generation. So it's going to be very interesting to see the dynamics play out.
Al?
I have a question for Ralph as well. In the United States, when we have something like this, and I think of the Twin Towers, there was the initial reaction was to unify
and
to pull together. And the support for President Bush went way up and stayed there for a long time. In the Japanese culture, is there a similar kind of thing that would occur?
I think for right now, you're going to see everyone in Japan coming together and rallying around the government. Moving forward, it's going to be very interesting as the Japanese people are hurt economically, how they're going to react. Are they going to want to continue with the government, or are they going to want to throw them out? You know, because obviously inflation will go up. They're going to have to pay higher taxes. They're really going to have to focus on bringing in international business and investment from other countries. And that's going to mean China, that's going to mean Australia, Singapore, the EU. I mean, when there have been disasters in the past, Japan has always been out there providing aid to other countries.
Right.
And I think it's fair for other countries now to reciprocate and help Japan in their hour,
Bob,
in time of need.
I have a question for Ralph as well. I think I'm right in saying that in the last year and a half, there have been, what, three different prime ministers, or I guess they call them.
Yeah.
I mean, is the government over there strong enough internally, is it stable enough to in effect, take the decisions and make the decisions that's going to have to be made to get Japan back on their feet, or are they too weak to do that?
It means the people are going to have to hunker down and accept some sort of adverse conditions in their life.
Yeah, well,
I think the older generation, no question, the younger generation is becoming more Western, more affluent, and they've always known a high standard of living. Now, for the first time, they're going to have to step back. It's going to be very interesting to see if this younger generation is going to be willing.
I mean, that begs a really good question. I mean, we saw how Japan reacted after World War II. They became an industrial and economic powerhouse. It's almost now... there's a sense of entitlement that is prevalent amongst the younger generation in Japan, in a culture that traditionally honors the older generation as being the wise ones, and they're very protective of their older generation. Is this the event that creates that break in that culture?
It could be. Because the older generation... The successful entrepreneurs came out of the military, where you had this dedication, this background, this training, this mindset, where you work hard and you are successful. And that's what pushed Japan through all the way through the 80s. Then the younger generation has become more affluent, and they become somewhat soft, similar to what's happening in our country with our kids coming up in the system. They haven't had to go through the military. They haven't had to suffer any kind of adversity. All they've known is affluence. And China, you're getting next generation coming up in China now that's very affluent, that's become very Western in their thinking. And the Chinese government, of course, is very concerned about that, because the older generation never knew prosperity. All they knew was hard times. So things got tough. They just hunkered down and put up with it. The newer generation in China, I don't know if they can handle high unemployment, loss of jobs. That's when you would see a real revolution and a change in the government.
What
are you seeing parallels, I think, in Japan and China among this new generation of young people?
Are we going to see the recovery in Japan that we saw after World War II, or is that long forgotten?
I think they're going to work very hard, but there's so many problematic factors. I mean, the world economy is not as strong. I mean, countries are not willing to invest the amount of money and resources like they were able to do even a few years ago with Haiti.
And Japan didn't do it overnight.
Right.
Yeah.
It took years.
It took years for them
to
build up. It took them arguably into the 70s, well into the 80s, for them to become that kind of economic powerhouse. When we look at Japan and we look at Japan as an ally, arguably this is going to possibly weaken their stature in the global community as far as a political effort goes. They're going to be so concerned about what's happening internally and the recovery from this disaster that they're really not going to be concerned outward. Do we now have to rely, does China now become more prevalent in the region, more so than they could have been before?
I think China's presence in the region is strengthened because of what's happening with Japan.
What is North Korea going to do in this?
Very interesting. I think it certainly creates an opportunity for them. No question.
How so?
They will perceive Japan as weak and ineffective. They will be focused on matters internally and are not going to be able to be concerned about international issues. So the North Koreans are going to feel that they're going to be able to continue their weapons program without any problems of Japan rearming. That's one of the concerns was, well, the U.S. should allow Japan to rearm and make the North Koreans afraid.
Right.
North Koreans are not going to be afraid that Japan is going to rearm. Japan's going to be focused on
rebuilding.
Right.
Wow. Wow.
Well, what if with all of this going on, North Korea with all of this going on, what if North Korea decides to invade South Korea?
Well, you have World War III. But that's where the Chinese are the X factor. The Chinese are the ones that still have control over the North Korean government. They still have that connection with them. It's waning somewhat because there are elements within the North Korean government that believe the Chinese have betrayed the cause and are moving more towards a Western style system, not of democracy, of an economic system,
a free economy.
Right. And in some circles in China, a democratic system in terms of the economy.
Right.
Well, I was just thinking that if the town is burning down, it's a great time to rob the bank.
Right. There's no question the North Koreans see this as an opportunity, but there are elements within their military that distrust the Chinese because they feel that the Chinese are no longer true to the beliefs of Karl Marx and Lenin. So you've got that factor weighing in, but certainly China can play a role in keeping North Korea under control because they still provide a lot of aid to them.
I have to ask this question based on Al's comment, is does this event, which was an act of God, does this possibly destabilize the Asian Pacific Rim?
I hope it wouldn't. That's why it's imperative that we focus on redevelopment efforts in Japan. Because you cannot have an unstable situation.
Bob, let me ask this question. I mean, politically, I mean, obviously from the comments that Ralph said, and Ralph being in the know, it's going to cause concern to members of Congress. Does Congress get involved at this point? What can we do?
Very, very, very little. I mean, we have no influence over North Korea.
Yeah.
We have minimal influence over the Chinese, particularly when they're going to be selling our bonds and we have problems there. We have very little impact. Anything we can do here is from a political policy sense, is going to be very, very minimal. I just don't see how we have any real levers at all in our possession.
Al, as a former member of Congress, had this happened on your watch, does this cause you concern as far as the fact that we're pretty much throwing our hands up in the air on the roller coaster and enjoying the ride?
I'm thinking. First of all, there is very little that Congress can do usefully because this really does require leadership from the State Department and the White House.
Which arguably, I mean, kudos to Secretary Clinton. I mean, she has literally, in the past 6 months, has had a hornet's nest to deal with internationally and diplomatically.
And I don't know, with all of her travels and what have you, to what degree she's trying to put together an international response to this. Our whole discussion has indicated we can't do it alone. Are these other countries going to come to help individually, or is there going to be a coordinated program of countries, which I think would be better, but very hard to put together? And I haven't heard whether she's whether she, we are trying to do that or not. I mean, it seemed to be in our benefit to get some allies and some allies' money and whatever.
I think this will be a major topic at the APEC meeting that's coming up in November.
Right. Right.
Also, I think the ASEAN countries.
The members of the ANZUS Alliance.
Yeah.
That ANZUS being Australia, New Zealand, U.S.
Right. All these countries play a tremendous role in being able to help rebuild Japan.
Yeah, but we got a problem there. I mean, there's still the New Zealanders, the Kiwis are still dealing with an 8.2 magnitude earthquake in Christchurch.
Right.
They've got their own internal problems.
Yes.
I mean, we've now come to a situation where. Acts of God, i.e. earthquakes, are now causing instability in political regions that we thought were more than stable.
And there's not enough aid money to flow around to all these countries. It's unfortunate.
It just isn't.
There isn't. So, from a policy standpoint, is have we overextended ourselves?
Yes.
Here we go. I've hit a nerve with Al. I've definitely hit a nerve with Al. Al, I'll pose this question to you. Have we overextended ourselves so much that these acts of God created or combined with the instability of North Africa and the Arab nations, is there anything from a policy or political standpoint we can do to offset or change that?
I hope there is. I'm not enough of a foreign policy expert, I'm not one at all, to know exactly how you do it. But now would be the time to try to act collectively rather than individually, because I don't know of any country in the world, with the possible exception of China, who could move in unilaterally and do it.
Bob, we've seen the UN come out and be, I hate to use the word, minimally proactive in its response to not only Japan but to what's been going on in North Africa and the Arab countries. This arguably would be a time for the UN to step up and truly earn its bones as a global entity, a global authority. Do you see that happening, or is the UN that weak?
I don't see it happening. Russia and China are strongly opposed to any action by the UN with respect to the Arab situation, the Arab country situation. So honestly, anything can happen there, really. I think that the European Union could support and would support, now that the Arab League is saying it's okay to do a flyover, you know, no-fly zone. I think it's possible to set that up, but I tend to think it's come too late, personally. With respect to moving on to the Asia side of it, it really comes down to how much can the world economy support and help the Japanese stabilize their country and pull and get the economy going again, and that is again a real serious problem. The European Union is having terrible problems internally trying to support its own members in the Eurozone because of their problems there with Greece. And
Ireland, Spain, Portugal,
maybe Italy. I mean, they have enough problems right there with trying to stabilize their own backyard, much less reach across the street to the next neighborhood. It's going to be pretty hard.
We're in the same position.
Yeah.
Amazing how we're all interconnected.
This brings up a good point. Here's the question to you, Ralph. You probably know. Where does the World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, fit into all this?
They can help setting up economic development projects. They can send teams there on the ground to identify projects and see about, you know, sending money over there. to help to help in developing the infrastructure.
I mean, there's been a lot of criticism. I mean, now would be a perfect time for an organization like the World Bank or the IMF to truly step up and be part of the global economy
and part of the
global community.
They'll make some loans to Japan.
But the question comes back is, the money coming out of the World Bank is only as good as the money going in, and there's not a lot of money going into the World Bank or the IMF right now. So is there an offset to that?
It's going to come back to Japan having to cash in the treasury bonds. I mean, this is the whole... We're kind of in a vicious cycle like this.
There are no good solutions. There are no easy solutions.
You want to ask the question about...
Al, go ahead. Go ahead.
I want to ask the question that you asked a moment ago about... What was the question you asked a moment ago?
About the UN?
Well, about the UN, but also, is there any way we can get a hold of this? And I think that there certainly is. There is certainly not a clear way where you have any certainty of how you get your hands around this. And it seems to me that if one does not exist, we need to try and form a coalition of OECD nations or others to approach this as a group rather than trying to do it individually.
But, you know, when we look at, you know, organizations like the G8 or the G20, you know, now we've got a situation where a majority of the members of the G8 and the G20 now, with Japan being in an economic turmoil as a result of the past events, you know, now it's going to use the terms of Prime Minister David Cameron of Great Britain, now's the time for austerity, which arguably, which is going to lead into a topic I know Bob and I want to talk about here in the last segment. We might as well run into it because it ties in, is if we're talking austerity, there's a lot of compromise that's going to have to be done on this budget. For those who don't know, it was reported earlier around the 4 o'clock hour that the House has approved a financial band-aid, for lack of a better term, giving a 3-week extension on the continuing resolution, allowing the government to operate for an additional 3 weeks. There's a lot of austerity concerns. Can the Democrats invoke that type of austerity and survive and stay on message, Al?
Well, it seems to me that John Boehner has at least given some strong hints that he is willing to bite off some political problems in order to try to deal with this. I have not heard a Democratic response to that. And it seems to me that now is the time to respond to that. We've all agreed on this program before that everybody's going to have to hold hands and jump at the same time. And I am not seeing any leadership anywhere among the Democratic leaders that they are aware they've got to get serious about this and stop just objecting to what the Republicans. I think what the Republicans are doing should be objected to, but I would like to see the counter proposals laid out so you can start the negotiating process, and I haven't seen that.
But well, you brought up a comment about the lack of leadership. I posed a question to Bob. Bob, has the president lost his ability to set the agenda? Has he just been sitting back too long?
The president never loses the ability to set an agenda. He can voluntarily decide not to do it, which he appears to be doing now. I do think that the best thing that's happening right now, and it's long-term rather than the immediate problem. But under the leadership of Senator Mark Warner of Virginia and Saxby Chandler of Georgia, one a Democrat, one a Republican, and a half dozen other senators from both parties, there's a serious effort to take a good hard look at the Bowles-Simpson report and pull the best parts out of that or things like it, and put together a package that will be helpful in the long term, which means, in effect, not this budget we're fighting over now, but the budget that covers the year 2012 from October 1st of this year until September 3rd of 2012. There's some really good efforts going on, but the president, unfortunately, seems to be just sitting there.
Al?
I agree. I mean, it seems to me that the president should have been the one to lay the Bowles Simpson on the table, and probably Alice Riblett one on the table. Say, here are two blueprints. Let's sit down and start taking them apart and looking at them. It had the advantage is it would not have had either Democratic or Republican fingerprints on it. And he didn't do it.
And Al, I beg the question then is, and not to throw you into the barrel, but it seems right now that the Republicans are the only ones coming up with plans for austerity, especially at a time as we've discussed today. I mean, if the four of us laymen are truly, truly coming up with the comments and ideas and thoughts that we are, that I've got to believe that members of Congress are thinking about this tenfold. Why are we seeing only Republicans and not many Democrats coming out with opinions and blueprints?
I wish I knew the answer to that, because as a Democrat, it is extremely troubling to me that they are not. That they are still the majority party.
They've got
the Senate and they've got the White House. And they should be generating something. And instead, John Boehner seems to be. Now, John Boehner, in my judgment, would be better able to do that if he didn't have the Tea Party dragging along behind him.
Right.
So you've got a guy that's pulling a huge albatross, who I think is trying to do the right thing from a Republican standpoint, which is fine. They're going to be a part of the problem.
Correct.
But I don't see anybody on the other side doing it as well.
Now, enough, Bob.
I have been critical today of the president doing nothing. But I would remind us all that one of the people who is sitting down with the group that Mr. Warner and Mr. Chambliss has created is Dick Durbin, senior senator of Illinois, and he was the senior senator of Illinois when Mr. Obama was a senator. They are very, very close. He's probably the closest senator to Obama personally, and he's in that group. Now, I would suspect it'd be a fair statement to say that he would not be in there if Mr. Obama didn't want him there. So I think that maybe, although Mr. Obama is unwilling to put his own, hand in the game, I think that Mr. Durbin may very well be his agent, although unidentified as such.
Well, I would hope so. And Dick Durbin is a very responsible, very bright, very capable guy. Who, if I were to pick a senator to be part of that group, I think it would be Dick Durbin. Either he or the senator from New York, although I'd prefer...
Chuck Schumer.
Yeah. I'd prefer Dick Durbin. He has a little less tendency to rush to the television cameras. And I think this is something that needs to be done with a little low profile. Durbin can work with a low profile.
Well, go ahead, Ralph.
When the American people, when they elected these representatives to Congress, believing they were going to support growing the economy and creating jobs, what point are the American people just going to get so fed up they're going to go to their members and say, you pass the budget, we're sick and tired of living in a bad economy, and you can't even get a budget resolved?
I'm saying this somewhat methodically. I think the American public gave up on Congress some time ago. I think whither the Tea Party. I think that was a reaction to bickering that has gone on for years now on Capitol Hill, and they have come up with oversimplified ideas. Their attitude is fix it.
Yeah.
You know, and they really have very little idea of how you go about fixing it. But the public, I think, at this point, is about where the Tea Party people are, in the sense that they say just fix it. And when we see people dallying and not coming up. I think if the president were actively involved in negotiations with the Republicans in the House and working with the Senate and seen doing that, I think he would calm a lot of the concern of the American people. But they don't see that, and I think it disturbs them greatly. And they apparently are going to take that out on the Democrats. And given the lack of leadership coming from Democrats that we've just discussed, that's probably appropriate.
Well, you know, it gets to a point where, you know, at some point the American people are going to say, you know, we need a leader. I need that voice. Who do I follow in this? Right now, the Republicans have really done a good job as far as showing, for lack of a better term, definitive leadership in this whole financial situation. And the Democrats, who should have been the one on stage, the one who we said it over the past 2 weeks, the one who usually has a bully pulpit in a possible government shutdown is the White House and the president. They've really not taken full advantage of the bully pulpit.
Well, that's the point. The whole point is the bully pulpit doesn't have anybody in it. There's nothing. Nobody's up there talking. It ought to be the president.
So that's got to cause concern for not only short term for the Democratic side of the shop, but long term. I mean, does this possibly affect the possibilities for an Obama second term?
I talked to a friend of mine who was an early and avid supporter of the president last night. And he said, Al, I will not vote for that man in 2012. I haven't talked to enough people to know whether that is isolated, but I suspect it's not.
I got to tell you something. I said it early on, and I'll say it again. Connecting the dots and going timeline by timeline, Obama is almost a carbon copy of the Jimmy Carter administration. Almost verbatim. Xerox. Same situations with international crises.
Well, he hasn't been caught in a boat with a killer.
Killer rabbit.
Right. Oh, that's true. And for the record, we hope that never happens, by the way. But the only thing we don't have today that we had during the Carter administration were gas lines. But we're not that far off from that.
We may not have gas lines, but we're hitting $4 and plus a gallon of gas on the West Coast right now.
Correct. So from a Democratic standpoint, can the Democrats recover, or have they just...
There is time to recover. You got to do something to recover.
But historically, from what we've seen in an administration that has not found a message that they can actively get out there, from a majority Congress that has been fairly, I use this term sparingly, ineffective as far as helping promote the message coming out of the administration.
We haven't seen diddly out of the Senate.
And the Senate's just being the Senate, and we know what a fan both of you are of the Senate as a whole.
Yeah.
We love the House.
Well, you're partial. You're biased.
But damn right.
But I mean, what we're seeing here is the Republicans obviously setting themselves up for a 2012, dare I say, landslide.
Well, you have to remind yourself, Justin, that while you're sitting here today and it looks like things are going a Republican way, you have to have a candidate. And as of right now, I think it's fair to say that there is no one who is putting their toe in the water, so to speak, among the Republicans who commands a particularly large following among the population. And most of them don't even have 20% approval among the, you know, they wouldn't be the choice of 20% of the Republicans.
You know what's really funny is you look at the ones who were considered up front runners. You know, Sarah Palin, her numbers are in the tank. Sarah Palin has decided not to run for president because she's making too much money. Governor Huckabee has decided that he don't want to run because he's making too much money on the talking head circuit. The ones who...
Why aren't we making more success?
Exactly.
There we are.
What are we doing wrong? I know we're doing wrong. I'm not a good-looking former beauty queen from Wasilla. I guess I will say that.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. I'm positive.
Put on a polar bear suit.
I'll be wearing a kilt on Thursday, and I will tell you it's not that pretty. You know, we look at... I mean, in the inner circles inside the Beltway, everybody's pretty much talked about Mitt Romney is just cocking the gun, ready to just unload. He's got everything in line. He's started becoming more vocal. We're starting to see a more centrist Mitt Romney than we did in the previous run.
Oh, he's gone from liberal to conservative to centrist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you gotta go where the votes are.
In addition to what all the public, the things you said that are all visible to the public, he has also been spending a great deal of time shoring up his support among folks back home that are in the leadership positions in the states and just different areas. He's raising a lot of money. He's developed some very good support team and some very good fundraising. He's done a great deal that we don't see this public, as well as what we do see this public.
But the one thing I would say that Mitt Romney has done is he is focused on one thing and one thing alone, that is the economy. He has been steadfast in addressing economic concerns. He himself has called for austerity. He himself has called out numerous times for a possible plan to help us in a recovery. And let's be honest, he's the one economic mind in the whole front runner sector that actually has credibility in finance.
Except for Newt Gingrich, who is raising tons of money.
But he has a lot of personal baggage, as we talked about last week.
Oh, of course he does. Yeah. But he's got a lot of money.
Yes, he does.
But social conservatives want to stick with him.
They have this far.
They have, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Certainly over Mitt Romney, they'll stick with him. So I don't know, but I think you always have to be wary of the candidate that's got a bundle of money, and he's got a bundle of money.
He does. There's no question about it.
I was talking 3 or 4 weeks ago with a very prominent Democrat, who I can't mention, who out of blue said, I'm very worried about Newt Gingrich. And I said, why? He said, he has so much money. And this guy was a pretty cute observer, so I don't think we can count. I'm not saying he's the leader.
Right, but we can't count now. No, by all means, Newt Gingrich is definitely a force to be reckoned with in the party.
And in addition to money, which is, of course, you've got to have it, he also has something else that a lot of candidates do not have. He has a lot of ideas. He loves to talk about them. And he is very articulate, so
yes.
he makes a persuasive case.
He is a very, very astute politician.
He is.
No question about it. We got the last 5 minutes here in the show this week, and I want to just touch in a couple of items. We get into our final segment, which is called Tell Me a Story. For not using Chris Matthews, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, but Tell Me a Story works. We go around the table and we talk about something that Bob Hines has done a good job of scooping a lot of the news media on some of the stuff he's talked about, so we'll continue that tradition going. But we're going to start off, Al, you're always going to go last because you still have to think of something. Ralph, tell me a story.
Leon Panetta will go to defense to replace Gates by the summertime.
Wow!
David Petraeus will come back
and go to
the CIA.
Wow! Folks, you heard it first. Ralph Winnie is calling that Director of National Intelligence, Leon Panetta, will become the next Secretary of Defense, replacing Secretary Gates, and that General David Petraeus will become the next Director of DNI.
We'll go to CIA.
Director of Central Intelligence,
yeah.
The DCI.
Right.
Wow. That's a big story.
Leon Panetta goes to defense. David Petraeus
goes to defense. CIA.
Yeah.
Can you top that one, Bob?
No, and I'm pissed. And I'll tell you why. Because I didn't have that second piece, but I had the first piece. And I could have seen, and if you'd have called on me first, I could have talked about Gates and Panetta, and then you could have had Petraeus. And I got...
Ladies and gentlemen, you are hearing a first. Yeah. Dr. Ralph Winnie has, in fact, scooped Bob Hines on Tell Me a Story. Bob, do we even have to go to you, or do you have something else?
I give up.
Bob's calling Uncle. Al, tell me a story.
Good for you.
Secretary of State Clinton will come back from her world tour talking to infinitely the broad range of things, and we'll sit down in the Oval Office and talk turkey to the president, and he just might start to leave.
Wow. Interesting thought. Last couple of minutes here on Backroom Politics. Again, we want to stress and reiterate the obvious. We hope that anybody out there listening, if you have the means, if you have the ability, give a lot or what you can to the efforts, the recovery efforts, to our friends in Japan. Our thoughts, prayers, and hope go out to the residents of the impacted areas and the families of loved ones who were lost. We really cannot tell you how much we value your support. We value your friendship and your alliance to our country. So go log on to American Red Cross. We're going to be posting. Ralph has you have something from the Japanese Embassy.
Yes, we'll post it on firstcongress.org. A direct request from the embassy to please support the victims from the Japanese earthquake. So
right.
Please go to our website.
So, again, we urge you to log on to www.firstcongress.org. Check out the First Congress Society. We invite your support. We invite your help. We appreciate your support in Backroom Politics. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am your moderator, Justin Russell. Thanks for joining us on Backroom Politics. We will see you next Tuesday, 4 to 6, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital.
The best place to be.
That's right.
And great beer.
And great beers, great cigars. Folks, on behalf of everybody here at Backroom Politics, this is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. We'll see you next week. Thanks again.